Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's going to turn this car around any time now. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Oh, you're much better than last week's audience. But what you don't know is last week's audience is a different audience because we're putting them out in a different order. So the joke's on you. And actually, you're nowhere near as good. Welcome to... You can make up for it now. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Zuni the Lazoon and Steve Zodiac from Fireball XL5 the other day. A TV series from 1962, 5 years before I was born. So this one's really testing. I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly around the universe. No? It's an early Gerry Anderson cartoon. Zuni's good. You should look out for Zuni. They call it Hullerstubber anyway. And I expect they call it Xulf as well. So I went to Pizza Express this week with my family. We go a lot. But we were taking the whole family, and I booked it. It was the one in Welwyn Garden City. You never need to book the one in Welwyn Garden City. The one in Hitchin, yeah, Sunday lunchtime, you need to book. Welwyn Garden City, don't worry, no one ever goes there. I think it's a front for some drugs or something. Probably can't say that due to libel laws, but it is. My son, though, I'd booked it, and my son went, I want to go to McDonald's. He's 5 years old. And he said, we're not going to McDonald's. I've already booked to go to Pizza Express. And he had a proper meltdown, right? He had a meltdown. He was crying. I want to go to McDonald's. I want to go to McDonald's. My wife is going, well, look, we can't go. He's having this meltdown. We're not going to go anywhere. I said, we have to go, because otherwise he wins. If we don't go to Pizza Express, he's won. And it went on. We started driving. It's a 20-minute drive to Welwyn Garden City. We were driving, he was still going, I want to go to McDonald's. I said, look, if you don't say you want to go to McDonald's again, next week I will take you to McDonald's. But if you say I want to go to McDonald's again, we're not going to go to McDonald's. He said, I want to go to McDonald's. He was playing it. He said it a lot more. It's very difficult being a parent. I like to see my kids as hecklers. And if you lose, if you lose your temper with a heckler, you've lost, right? But I completely lost my temper. I said, I'm going to turn this car around. If you don't shut up, going to turn this car around. And we got to a roundabout, and I went round the roundabout, and I started going back home again. I knew there was another roundabout we could turn around again. But I was driving, like, sort of angry. It's very day. It could have taken the whole lot of us out, to be honest. And we drove around, we came back, and he was still going, I want to go to McDonald's, and he's crying. My wife is going, we have to go home. He's not going to stop crying. We got to Wellingyard City. He walked past the McDonald's. He didn't see it, thank God, but he was still going, I want to go to McDonald's. We got into Pizza Express. He went, oh, I'm hungry. It's absolutely fine. Sat down there, didn't cry. He'd literally cried for an hour and a half. Once he got there, yeah, fine, I'll have dough balls. Prick. Absolutely. But I became that, you know, I never thought I'd be the dad. He's going, if you don't shut up, I'm going to turn this car around. Right! It's amazing any children grow up, get old enough to be adults, isn't it? Because, you know, the number of families that must have been wiped out in a car accident must be a lot, mustn't it? Right, my guest this week... is probably best known for being a writer on Rob Rinder's Good Year, Bad Year, though he's not just a writer, he's also appeared in When TV Animals Go Horribly Wrong. So I'm presuming he's like a vet programme, just opening up Bouncer from Neighbours, finding out it's got liver cancer. And I can think of no better introduction. Please welcome Ishan Akbar, ladies and gentlemen. Here he is. Oh, I'm giddy. I'm in a giddy mood again. I'm in a giddy mood. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. What was Rob Rinder like to write for? Was he a good guy?
Well, actually, I didn't quite write for Rob. I wrote for a comedian who was doing the show. A comedian called Tez Ilyas. So I wrote for him. I met Rob, actually, at the recording for Good Year, Bad Year, and he was fine.
Yeah. It's good to get it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, nothing.
Best friends with Benedict Cumberbatch. Was Benedict Cumberbatch around?
He wasn't, unfortunately. No. It was just Rob and Tez, and Rob was, you know, fine. Nothing more. I keep saying fine like it's an insult. What I mean is there was nothing interesting to report.
Nothing happened. So, and what about TV Animals Go Horribly Wrong?
I loved doing that show.
Yeah.
Like, when I started doing comedy, I had no ambitions really to become a comedian. This just happened by mistake. I'm here by mistake.
Yeah.
But I always dreamed of doing shows like TV Animals Do the Stupidest Things and Football's Funniest Moments, because I used to watch them at Christmas all the time.
Yeah.
I was like, it was always going to be quite nice to actually do them. And then I realised they do it all in front of a green screen. Didn't realise that until I did them. So that was fun to do.
Yeah.
There was a goat that spat on a man.
I wouldn't say that's horribly wrong. I mean, horribly wrong, by a goat that bites a man's face off.
Well, yeah, I know, but precisely.
Yeah.
What else did we have? We had a horse that kicked a man.
Yes.
Basically, a lot of bad things happen to men. Which, if you're a woman, you're probably quite happy about.
Did you do the elephant from Blue Peter doing a poo?
Yes, there was
and good.
There was someone on. There was a. Wasn't there a dog or something? No, a pony.
Yeah.
Was it a pony that did a shit on Good Morning Britain or something?
Oh, was there? I don't know all the animals that have done shits on TV.
I am the expert.
You're the expert. I've never been on TV Animals Go Horribly Wrong. Well, that's very good. That was all I wanted to talk to you about. Thanks for coming in.
No problem.
It's all been very good. As you say, this is an interesting career trajectory for you. You've done quite a lot of different things, but you were working as a banker mainly, is that right?
Yes.
Until the banks all went wrong.
Yes. So
was that your fault? Is that why you had to stop working there?
In a very small way, yes. I was a private banker to celebrities. So I did wealth management to loads of famous people, footballers, actors, actresses, a couple of comedians who shall remain nameless. you know, I was like 21, fell into the banking world a bit. Did the job, and then by 2008, I was like, oh, A, I'm not very good at this, and B, it's just I just didn't want to do it. So when the financial crisis happened, in a weird kind of way, it was quite a cool thing to happen.
Yeah,
it
made me think of that.
I've fallen into everything I've ever done.
Yeah.
I've never really had a plan. Like when I was 6 years old, I remember in primary school, the teachers asked us what we want to be when we grow up. And all the kids like said plumber, fireman. One person said he wanted to be an imam.
Okay.
Quite a weird ambition, that one. And I said I wanted to be an ambassador.
Oh.
And everyone beat the shit out of me. Because, like, I had uncles and friends who were ambassadors, and I thought that was the thing I wanted to do. But when I read Economics University, ended up becoming a banker, left banking, became a government policy advisor, left that, became a speechwriter, and then found comedy. And 9 years later, I'm on Rare Lester Burn. My life is fucking weird.
You also worked as a choreographer for Bollywood... In Bollywood films?
I was a Bollywood dance choreographer part-time.
It doesn't sound like a part-time job. Like a full-time job to me.
It paid terribly. I started kind of... Basically, I was like the fat kid who danced at weddings, aged 8 and 9. And people were like, actually, you're pretty good at this. Do you mind teaching my son something for his wedding or whatever? And then it kind of grew. And by the age of like... 18, I had a dance troupe of 8 boys and 8 girls.
Right.
For some inexplicable reason, and I cannot believe this, we were called the Blue Badges.
The Blue Badges.
And there was no one disabled. And none of us realised what it meant. So the Blue Badges were going all over the country doing these Bollywood dance performances. And then when I was kind of 20 years old, I wanted to go to India and do it professionally.
Yeah.
And my parents said no, basically. I've not done dancing. The last time I did a dance was actually in December last year. I did on another podcast called Have a Word. We did a Bollywood dance to 10,000 people at the M&S Bank Arena.
Wow.
And that was it was fun to get back to do it.
Yeah.
But I also realised I cannot do it anymore. I'm too fat. Also, I've learned recently, I don't think I know how to wear trousers properly.
Right.
Because, I mean...
How are you wearing it?
Okay, well, what... Because you've got a bit of a belly, if you don't mind my saying.
I have a little bit of a belly.
Yeah, and I've got a belly.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is the most comfortable place for me to place my belt is above the belly button.
Right.
But that's too high.
Yeah.
So then the next bit is, like, on the belly button.
Yeah.
But that's not secure. So it slides down.
Yeah.
The obvious place is to put it, like, just under the belly.
Yeah.
The tightest place. But then my belly hangs out,
yeah.
So I feel a bit weird about it.
Yeah.
And I've just realised, in my late 30s, in the last week, I actually don't know how to wear my trousers properly.
Yeah, there's...
Do you wear your trousers?
Well, I've been having a problem. I've actually put on, like, weight, I would say, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, right? So I've not been exercising because I've been ill.
Just in the last 2, 3 weeks?
Yeah, apparently. I was putting on weight.
I love how he tried to slip that in. Before that, he was doing Tough Mudders on the weekly.
I was doing well up. I've been putting on weight. I lost a lot of weight. I had cancer.
Here we go. You're fine now.
But then I got decided to get fit, so I got quite fit. So I lost quite a lot of weight, and I gradually
did the cancer help with the weight loss?
No.
Okay.
Gradually, I lost like the weight of a testicle pretty quickly.
Right.
But I got quite. I was in bed for about a month. I got quite fat while I was, you know, recuperating, and then I did lots of running.
Yep.
And got as fit as I've been for 4 or 5 years. And I kept up for a bit, and then it's been just sliding, as you'll have known. People who watch the videos of this, and you can see the slide.
Yeah.
But I would say in the last 2 or 3 weeks, it's got noticeably worse. Right. And my trousers are now underneath the belly, and fall down all the time.
Oh, because I thought if they were under the belly, you could tighten them.
Well, it's been a real problem. My trousers falling down.
Yeah.
Because I'm fat. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I walk my dog, and 50% of our walking is me fixing my trousers.
Yeah.
And like I've got one of these extendy leads for the dog, and sometimes I'll forget that she's not on full extension, so I'll just yank my dog and pull my trousers up.
Yeah.
It's quite a poor
little
thing.
If you put weights in your trousers, that could become like an exercise thing.
That could be.
And then you might actually lose the weight if you...
All right, now you sound like my mum. That's not great.
Put 10 kilos in each pocket.
Just do some exercise. And then in my wisdom, I thought... I think it was last year I decided I'd buy some, like, those braces things.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking hell. They just kept pulling my trousers higher and higher because... because the triple XL braces
yeah.
aren't They're not big enough. Anyway, that's my trouser issue.
Yeah. Since lockdown, I discussed this a few weeks ago, I've been unable to shake hands with people because we stopped shaking hands.
Right.
And now every time I shake hands with someone,
yeah,
it goes really badly wrong. I've forgotten how to shake hands. I'm like, let's try it. It might be all right because I'm concentrating.
Because you're concentrating.
Yeah, but okay, let's just put it.
Okay. I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
Let's not shake hands now because you're concentrating.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll just offer my hand at a random time in the podcast.
But a few times I've done, we don't shake hands anymore. It's kind of fallen out of favour. And I've only done it five or six times since lockdown. And I would say three or four times I've grabbed the wrong bit of the hand.
Oh, is that okay?
Yeah. So really badly. I mean, it might be the other person's, but it might be everyone's bad at it.
Yeah.
So you're going in. It's like going in for a kiss and your nose is bumping. You
know? Yeah, yeah.
Just going in for a handshake and it just turning into me holding someone's fingers.
I've held recently. It was Ramesh here. Ramesh Ranganathan here. We were doing a gig together, and I went to shake his hand, and somehow I just held his four fingers.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
And then
about.
He just looked at me and went, why why did you do that? And I went, oh, I don't know, to kiss it? I don't know.
It's a weird thing when it goes wrong.
But these are the kind of things that you don't get taught.
No.
Like, no one... there's no lesson on how to, like, wear your trousers properly or shake hands properly. You just kind of learn by seeing other people.
Yeah.
And not everyone does it properly.
No.
Who wears their trousers above their belly button? Give me a cheer. Oh! The women do, because it looks good. On the belly button? No. Under the belly button? Yeah. And like under the belly? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah. I mean, some people don't have a belly. Some people don't have.
Everyone's got a bit of a belly.
No.
I mean, your audience.
These guys.
I don't know why I'm shit. I can't even see you, to be honest.
You're right, though. Choked to death then. That's good. So how did after this? So you're a banker. How did that become? Was it through you were doing a bit of broadcasting and someone suggested you become a tryout comedy? How did it? Given you weren't interested particularly in becoming a comedian,
yeah,
which is sort of interesting. You know, it's interesting that most comedians I think like have this calling.
Yeah,
not all by any means, but like you know, yeah. For me, I was 4 years old and wanted to be a clown, wanted to be a writer, wanted to write stories. A teenager, I really wanted to be a comedian. That obviously wasn't grabbing you as you were doing your badge dancing.
No, I mean, the thing is, Bollywood does have, to a certain extent, it has a level of, you know, comedy in it. You know, you see a man of my size dancing, that's inherently quite funny, I think. But then, you know, I'd always done something on the side of my serious job, and that's something all members of my family did, particularly my mum's side, you know, irrespective of how serious their jobs were. Like, my granddad, for example, he was a barrister, and he helped write the Constitution of Bangladesh.
Right.
Very serious man.
Yeah.
But he was also like a poet, so he wrote loads of published poetry in Bengali, none of which I fucking understand. But people did that kind of stuff, and I thought to myself, I just did it. When I was in banking for a long period, I was in an amateur dramatic society. They were called the Spread Eagle Players. Why do I have these weird name things?
I mean, that's basically legs akimbo.
Yeah, which again, it didn't occur to me at the time, but nevertheless, I was in there and had a nice time. And then comedy was just one of those things where I thought, I was always like the funny guy in the group. And a couple of my friends were like, hey, maybe you should just do comedy like as a side thing.
No.
Did it as a side thing, and within two gigs, I just absolutely fell in love with it. And I was like, oh, shit, this is great. And then I started learning about comedians. I didn't know anyone, really. When I started doing comedy, the only people I'd heard of were Richard Herring.
Yeah, number one.
Michael McIntyre, Paul Chowdhury, and Russell Peters.
Right.
Because he was an Asian comedian, like a global icon. And that was it. And I hadn't heard of people I love now, the Bill Burrs, the Dave Chappelle's of this world, and started learning. So in many ways, I think it's worked to my favour because I wasn't that hungry for it in the same way.
Yeah.
So I was just happy and excited for whatever happened. And whatever happened in the last 9 years has been all right.
Yeah.
I've had a nice time. It's going okay, yeah.
Yeah, it is going okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to know. You can just waltz into it. Yeah, I'll give this a go. Oh, yeah, I'm on TV. Yeah, that's fine.
Hey, listen, the thing is, what's interesting is whenever I do anything on TV, I get one group of people who say, well, we know why you got that. Asian bloke, fat, deaf, obviously. And then there's Asians who are like, we know why you got that. Fucking white man, sell out. Like, and it's just weird. I can never make anyone happy, but I don't know. I just try and have a nice time, and I feel very grateful for all the opportunities that have come my way and just enjoy this.
Yeah. Doing it, yeah. But that's interesting. Phil Wang, when he was on, and has written a fantastic book about it as well, about being, you know, not Asian enough or Chinese enough for Chinese people and not English enough for English people. And so, you're born in the UK, East London.
Yep, East London, Whitechapel.
But you don't feel, you know, when you go to, I've forgotten where your parents are from different places, right?
So my dad's from Pakistan and my mom's from Bangladesh.
Yeah, so when you go to Bangladesh, you don't feel Bangladeshi. Or they don't. You're not Bangladeshi enough for them.
Yeah. Weirdly, when I go to English was the fourth language I learnt to speak.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to speak English at home until I was about 7 years old.
Right.
So I have a fluent grasp of Bengali, Urdu, Hindi, Punjabi, because of that's just how the world ended up working. And when I go to Bangladesh or I meet Bangladeshi people or Pakistani people in the UK who've just arrived, often they'll ask me how long I've been in the UK because I just end up becoming super Asian. Like singing, dancing, right. The whole kit and caboodle. And they're just like, I just want to calm the fuck down, it's fine. But what will happen is British Asians often will police my level of Asianness. I mean, I was a presenter on the Asian Network for a year and a half. They changed the controller who came in and told me I wasn't Asian enough to be on the Asian Network. Now, if you're here in the audience, you can clearly see I'm fucking Asian. Do you know what I mean? It's just a weird thing. And I think part of it is because it might be because of the way I sound. People often comment on the way I speak.
Yeah.
I just think it's London. But people seem to think it's a bone of contention. I don't practice Islam anymore. I used to be quite a devout religious person. Now I'm someone who enjoys his life. But I talk quite openly about that. I have a dog. I go to drag shows. And apparently those things kind of negate me from being Asian, according to British. It's a very odd thing.
Yeah.
Whilst at the same time, you know, I've done gigs for people like Lee Hurst.
Okay.
In, you know, proper right-wing parts of Kent and Essex, where I've gone on stage and the audience have stopped clapping as soon as I step onto the stage.
Right.
And won them over. But they've started by saying you're not fucking English, and I am. I can't be anything but English, really. I don't really understand it, so it's a bit of a weird thing. I'm going through a bit of an identity thing at the moment.
It is, but I think from a comedian's point of view, it's quite that's an interesting place to be. Maybe for as a person, it's an odd place to be and a scary place to be in sometimes. But from a comedian's point of view, he's feeling like an outsider, and you know. Where not feeling sort of like at home quite anywhere, or you know, or just feeling like you just having that step back, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Really,
yeah,
you've got to step back and you can look at both or all cultures. And
but it's not also just that. I think sometimes I think people get frustrated with me. One of your former guests, Rosie Holt, I do a podcast with her every week called Non-Censored, and she once described me as being someone who's infuriatingly untribal. So, what will happen? I'll say things on Twitter. And people have come up to me and been like, oh, my God, you seem like a proper right-wing Tory. And I'm like, well, on some issues, I am. I'm not. I can feel the tension. But the thing is, I hold really dear to my heart, I hold this idea that I don't want people to come and see me because they agree with me politically. Mm-hmm. Nor do I want them to come and see me because they feel like they have to support an Asian comedian. The things that my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation went through in this country gives me the audacity of equality. So I want to be able to, I want to be seen in the same merits as everybody else. You know, whenever papers write about me, they'll often say, oh, he's like a hybrid of Ramesh and Nish. Mm. But they'll never say he's like a hybrid of, I don't know, Richard Herring and, you know, Michael McIntyre. That just won't happen. And despite the fact that for years my Twitter handle was Michael Packintyre. which I had to retire for this tour because my promoters were like, you can't be doing that. So yeah, it's a weird thing, and I think like I don't necessarily subscribe to ideas of like being seen as a person of colour. I don't like that phrase.
No.
And there's a cabal within comedy that seems to really like that, and I'm not part of it. By the same token, I'm not as right wing or free speech as some of the other people, but I try and weirdly, I sometimes feel like I'm a bit of an outsider within comedy.
Yeah.
And that seems like quite a self-indulgent thing to say, but it's kind of transpired that way. I don't know why, but that's.
But I think, you know, it's sort of weird. I mean, I think in the old days, a comedian, you know, sort of, even a political comedian sort of stood outside politics, or at least, I mean, most people as well would just, they wouldn't go, I believe I'm left wing. And so yes. I believe everything that left wing. You go, well, I think this and I think that. And, you know, I agree with this here and I agree with that there. They would have an individual opinion about the world. And it wouldn't all have to be in exactly the same box as everyone else. Yeah. And now it has become a little bit like, or the assumption, I think, is, you know, people are, you know, I'll get, you're a left-wing comedian. You go, well, you know, I'm probably, yeah, if you averaged it out. But, yeah, yeah. You know, I think this about this. I believe in free speech. You know?
Yeah. So
I believe that, you know, that everyone, no one should really be sacked off from TV for just saying something unless it's illegal. Yeah. So, you know, it's... You know, it's weird the way it's become sort of so tribal now, I suppose. So anyone sort of standing outside of that and going, well, I think this and that, that should be the norm, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of, like I said, I hold that quite dear to my heart because I just want to try and be funny over and above everything else. I think one of my happiest moments in my comedy career was in 2016 at the Edinburgh Fringe, when I was made the pick of the Fringe by the North London Jewish Chronicle and the Daily Mail. And I was like, I'm fucking good at this. What a lovely place to be. But yeah, it is a weird thing. I feel nowadays there just seems to be... Well, I say nowadays, I've been doing this 9 years, not a very long time, but it seems like there is this sense that comedians have to be the mouthpieces on socio-political issues, and the lines have been blurred over the last few years, and I just don't want to do that. That's just not my inclination. And so I will say things that sometimes seem a bit beyond the pale or not necessarily conforming to certain left-wing ideologies or whatever. And, you know, I've been dropped from work because people just think that I'm Tory because of what I've said online. And you just think, well, maybe they're jokes, like my profile says comedian.
And the job is to find the funny, you know, is to find the funny in stuff. So, you know, that it is sort of standing back and going, well, I can laugh at this and I can... Yeah. And take the piss out of this. You know, I think it's sort of a comedian really shouldn't be so ideologically like nailed down to something that they can't see what's funny about the thing. It's sort of interesting to me that, I mean, we're both brought up in religious households. I think yours might have been more religious than mine, but my parents were both Christians, and I did a show in which I sort of just examined why I'd turned to atheism and my relationship with Jesus. But you've, you know, you're maybe more a bit more boldly, you've taken on the Islam and the Quran and moving away from that faith.
Yeah, so my second show at the Edinburgh Fringe, I took the Quran on stage and talked about bits I thought were funny and didn't make sense, and part of the reasons why I left, but also things about that were beautiful. The show was called Prophet Like It's Hot. I was very proud of that title, actually. So I grew up in a household that was religious, that would identify as Muslim, but again, I had quite a liberal upbringing when it came to religion. Yeah, my mum always said to me that it was just the lottery of life that I was born a Muslim, so she would say that Islam is the best, but if I was born a Jew or a Christian, then she'd be saying exactly the same thing. Yeah. And I'd had a long period of really grappling with faith. I was really quite devout. I used to lead the call to prayer in my mosque.
Okay.
I had to do an X Factor style audition for that. It's genuinely true. At the age of like, I think weirdly, a lot of religious singers need to be prepubescent. I think it just sounds better.
Yeah.
So I think it was like 9 or 10. And the imams and some of the community leaders brought us into this room and made us audition to do the recitation of the call to prayer, which you might have heard if you've been to Turkey or Morocco. And I smashed it. I absolutely smashed it. 3 yeses. Alicia was crying. It was fucking amazing, right? But then Assad did it. Oh, poor Assad. Assad did it. There was a crack and he kind of forgot a bit of the prayer.
Oh.
And the imam told him that, and Assad was like 9. And he told Assad that it was such an abomination from hell that even the devil would be embarrassed to accept him.
Yeah.
It's quite a good roast, to be fair.
It is, but I don't know, if it was such an abomination from hell, the devil would be pleased.
Yeah,
to
right?
You, right?
Do you know what I mean?
Because it would be have to be quite, it would have to be in the middle for the devil to be upset as
right,
well.
Right, precisely. But then, yeah, so then I eventually got to a point where I was like, I don't really, I made a separation between God, the soul and the body. I didn't think that God was that bothered about what I was eating and drinking. I felt like that was a bit of a waste of his time, to be honest. And because I talk quite openly about it, it's a weird thing, because I talk openly about not practicing Islam, a lot of Muslims are very angry with me. And will discount me, well, they discount me as being Asian, actually, which is odd because Islam is quite a diverse faith group. So that happens. And people will also feel like they can weirdly be Islamophobic because I don't practice anymore. Right. That also doesn't work because people I love and care for deeply, and a lot of Islamic philosophy I find beautiful. So I find myself as an outsider there too. Oh, my God, I'm such an outsider. I should call one of my shows The Outsider or something, I don't know. But, yeah, yeah. So I have kind of... I don't really practice Islam anymore.
No, but that's, you know, that's the same... My Christ on a Bike show was, you know, was me trying to work out why I was so obsessed still with Jesus, even though I'd sort of given up on... You know, I'd sort of turned my back on it, really. Yeah, you know, sort of 8 or 9, I was into it. Yeah. And then... sort of thought this is crazy.
So would you say you're an atheist?
I would say I'm an atheist, but right. I'm an atheist who, you know, is quite obsessed with religion, and because I'm like interested in history, I'm interested in why religions have happened. But equally, I still have that. You know, I still, even when I did Christ on a Bike the first time, I still had like a little bit of discomfort. Even doing stuff that was, you know, in the end, the show is about saying, you know, I think Jesus is pretty. You know, it's pretty cool, and it makes more sense if he's a human being. It's only impressive if he is a human being. If he's a god, it's sort of less impressive that he was things that whatever that religion came up with. But you know, there's a lot to admire from it. And you know, I think if you're brought up in a faith, that it's sort of even if you turn against it, it's still within you.
Like,
right?
Even now, you know, my mum sadly passed away 9 years ago, and I try and visit her grave, which is not far from my house, kind of every week. And when I stand by her grave, I will say prayers as I learned them as a child in Arabic, and they are Muslim prayers. And that's my way of connecting to my mum, as opposed to this idea of Islam or God. And, you know, my primary kind of reason for leaving was I never believed in the idea of doing something good on earth with a view to a reward in an afterlife that I haven't fucking seen.
Yeah.
You know, that I've no idea it exists. And so when I've said this on other podcasts or other things, I've had Muslims say to me that I shouldn't be allowed to even say those prayers. And, you know, that's my relationship with my dead mother, you know. And so the fact that so many people, be it Muslims or otherwise, feel like they're able to cast judgment about how someone else chooses to live their life, which is the world we seem to be living in, be it about your political allegiances, your gender identity, your sexual identity, I think is fucking stupid. Just let people live the way they want to. Do you know what I mean? I think it's just, it doesn't matter what it is. And so all this policing that goes on, I just think is really baffling. And thank you for the applause, but I did feel a bit like Nish Kumar then. It made me sick.
But is there an element of doing, you know, because most comedians would shy away from Islam and or just do a joke about, I would joke about the Quran, but, you know, I don't want to be murdered or whatever. Yeah, yeah. So is that, you know, you've actually done it and you've actually done material about it.
Yeah.
Do you feel an element of danger to that?
I've had death threats. I had a guy turn up with a knife at a gig.
Did you?
A guy turned up, he saw me at Backyard Comedy Club, and after the gig he walked up to me, and I thought it was a fan, and he walked up to me and he said, don't do that again. And I said, well, don't do what again? And he goes, don't make jokes about Islam again. And I was like, well, are you my agent? I don't know, have you browned up? What's happened here? And he goes, no, if you do that again, there'll be problems. I was like, all right. And then the next week he turned up in his stupid wisdom and decided to show me the knife that he was carrying.
Okay.
And I like a bit of attention. So I went on stage and told him to put the house lights up and said, oh, there's a man over there, he's carrying a knife, he wants to stab me. And the security came and grabbed him and got rid of him.
Right.
I thought it was a really baller move from me. See, I'm very good at dealing with those situations that are tense like that. The first time I was ever called the P word, age 24, at Dagenham Road Football Club, I wrote an article for The Guardian, and I smashed it. And that's very different to how my dad would have dealt with it, which is beating the shit out of him. So, so people have been angry. Even just this weekend, I had loads of faceless Muslim trolls who told me that I was fat, ugly, and shit at comedy because I'm selling out my religion. And only one of those things is true. And whichever one you thought, that's actually quite offensive. So that's really unacceptable, actually.
it's really interesting stuff, and it's, you know, it's, I think, like, being on, just because I've had situations where I'm on stage, and in real life, I would, you know, I'm not a brave person, I'm not a confrontational person, but I've been on stage and I've done things that, you know, like, I've talked about this before, but, like, in Older Shot, there was, like, basically squaddies who'd come to see two Edinburgh previews. One was John Oliver and Andy Zaltzman talking about politics, and mine was me talking about the Hercules Terrace, the 12 Tasks of Hercules.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, no, another fucking one when I came on, and then he sort of walked out, and he came onto stage, was nose to nose with me, like, because it was, you know, he was just stepped down, and he was on stage, and I was just, and I stayed completely calm and carried on taking the piss out.
Was it slightly erotic?
I don't think it was erotic. It might have been for him.
Okay.
Of course. But I was absolutely, you know, I wasn't, you know, he was probably in the SAS or something. You know, he was like a, you know, these are hard men. He could definitely have killed me.
Yeah.
In a second. And I absolutely just, like, stood there and didn't, you know, and was as bold as anything. Whereas if that happened in real life, I would have completely run away.
Well, that's better than what I did once. There was this one gig where a man jumped onto the stage similarly.
Right.
He took umbrage to a joke. This wasn't a Muslim person. It was just a drunk guy at the Piccadilly Comedy Club. And he jumped onto the stage with a view, I presume, to attack me. This is how much of a private school education I had. I got the microphone and took a fencing position. I was like... Then he grabbed the mic and the security guard took him off. And I was like, Ishan, you're such an embarrassment to your East London roots. Such an embarrassment. But there we go.
It's a very, we know, we're very brave people.
We are brave boys. Two brave boys.
We're very brave.
Two brave. We'll smash you up, bruv. You get me?
I'm going to ask you some emergency questions.
By all means.
We sort of alluded to this backstage a little bit, but not really. Have you ever seen a ghost?
Well, I haven't, but my family members insist that there was a ghost in the house that I was taken to when I was born.
Okay.
That sounded like I was abducted. What I meant was the house that I was born in. So basically, there was numerous members of my family, my mum's side, they all absolutely 100% believe that there was a spirit haunting the house. So when I was born, like, the cradle would rock, and my mum would hear, like, steps going up and down. And you know, my dad was at home and she was at home alone. And then my mum's eldest brother, he came over to the UK to do, like, a master's in engineering or something. And he's one of those people, because he does engineering, he's very straight down the line. And he started moaning at my mum that every night someone was running around the stairs.
Right.
We eventually moved out, and then we found out some 2 months later that the owner previous to the last one had killed himself in that house. And the reason the last owner left was because he believed that the spirit was still possessed. So apparently when I was a kid, I got pushed around by a ghost. I never saw it. But there's also reports of, like, my mum said that when my grandfather passed away, he had in the window the moments before he died seen my eldest uncle, who was executed by the Pakistani army during the war in 1971. This was in 1988. He'd seen him at the window beckoning him.
Right.
And my grandfather walked to the window and said, I'll be with you in just a moment, went to his bed and told my mum, tell your mum to give me my tea later, and then passed away.
Wow.
So it does happen, apparently, but
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they were smoking something. I found my mum's illegal stash of Bloody Mary ingredients after she died. And I was like, what a woman. That's great.
Good. Well, that's I'm scared and excited.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I mean, you know, the chances of this one paying off are small. Have you ever been potholing?
Have I ever been potholing?
Potholing, yeah.
What is potholing? As in, what
it's
is
when
it?
You go into... okay, if you're worried about your trousers, don't go potholing. It's when you go into caves and sort of crawl around. Nish did it. That's part of the reason I asked the question.
Yeah, we're an Asian WhatsApp group. Yeah. We're like, can you do the whitest experiences just to fit in, please? Camping next.
I've never done it, and I used to work in Cheddar Caves where you could.
Did
go
you? Okay, really? Yeah. No, I've never gone potholing, and I don't think I ever wanted to.
Any adventures within nature that you would partake in?
Well, here's the thing. In my wisdom, I have started dating a very middle-class white woman. And her family are very well-to-do, and her uncle's got a place in the lakes in Coniston. It's all very lovely.
Very nice.
And they drag me along in the summers, and they go for these fucking walks with no purpose. Just walking around, and I don't know what it is with middle-class people absolutely fetishising poverty. They fucking love it. Like, if there's a walk, if there's a camping to do, if there's festivals with no fucking hygiene, they want to go. And it's the one big aspect of my relationship that I absolutely detest. I hope she doesn't listen to this. And so I have, in the last few years, taken to the odd walk.
Okay.
And, you know, it's the cafe at the... They kind of, all of my girlfriend's family have said to me, the reward is going to the cafe at the end of the walk. And I'm like, this is the bleakest cafe on the fucking planet. Like, the salad is so old and they serve salad and it's just... So nature and I aren't natural bedfellows,
no.
I'd say.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I used to go to my great uncle's tea gardens, which he was gifted with. Well, actually, his grandfather was gifted for services to the empire. He was knighted by the British Empire for service to the empire. And on it, they said social work, but he was actually a spy. What a turncoat. He used to be like, these Bengalis aren't paying tax. You want to fucking sort them out for you? And they got four tea gardens.
Wow.
So when I was a kid, I used to go around these tea gardens, and I'm a coffee drinker now, so.
Okay. It sounds like you come from a pretty amazing family. There's some heritage.
Just there. My mum's side. My dad's dog shit. My mum's side of the family are very highfalutin, interesting people.
Yeah.
My dad's side of the family are fine, you know. Nothing major to report. Oh, there is one thing.
Yeah.
I discovered this in the last 6 months, and honestly, I'm going to write a show about it one day. So basically, my dad's side of the family, my dad is a very salt-of-the-earth immigrant story. Came to this country when he was 15, was a minicab driver, worked in a bakery, forklift driver, he's a paramedic now. He likes driving, clearly. you know, that side of the family, yeah, my grandfather on my dad's side, he was a carpenter and joiner. So nothing, you know, particularly major to write home about in that sense. And we were talking to my uncle, who has recently kind of found Islam again. He's a very religious man. He'll refuse to come over to my house because we've got a dog. And he's found Islam again after having 4 affairs. but we won't talk about that. He's not going to listen to the podcast, so it's fine. And we were talking about kind of the history of our family, kind of a who do you think you are thing. And I didn't know this. So you might be aware in the room, because you're Richard Herring fans, you're very well-to-do, well-read, you'll be aware of the caste system. So in India, it's particularly big, the caste system. But in Pakistan, not really quite as big. But I'd learned that we do have a caste. And my uncle said that no one in the family ever talks about the caste because it's embarrassing. It's an embarrassing slight on the family. My great-great-great-grandfather on that side was so embarrassed that we were this caste, he wanted us to extricate ourselves from that caste and become carpenters and joiners. And I asked him, well, what's this caste? And he said, the caste is, they're called the Mirassis. I said, okay, what are the Mirassis known for? And he said, well, they're known for being comedians and entertainers. And I'm not joking. Apparently there's a caste there, Mirassis, who share that same surname, who are comedians, entertainers, singers, who would basically go around to weddings and go around to the village and tell jokes and sing songs, and people just throw money at them. And this idea of having money thrown at you just to entertain people at weddings was so embarrassing to my great-great-great-grandfather that he wanted to extricate himself from any association with it. And 4 generations later, somehow, here I've ended up. And I just think it's such a fascinating thing about how human beings and history kind of repeats itself.
Yeah.
So here I am as a comedian entertainer, and man, people throw a lot of fucking money away.
People throw money, and basically it's a shameful, terrible job.
Yeah, it's a shameful, terrible.
Your family.
My dad was asked 4 weeks ago what I do for a living by some woman, and he said, well, he used to be a banker. That was a long time ago, Dad.
So let's quickly talk about your new tour, which you're on tour now. You're, in fact, coming to Leicester Square Theatre for a couple of gigs. So if anyone here wants to get tickets.
Yes, so 28th of April is sold out, and I've got another date on the 20th of May. So if you want to come to that, that'd be lovely. Terrific. We'd love to see you.
So it's the Pretender
tour. It's called The Pretender, yes.
And what can we expect from The Pretender?
Lots of good bants like you've heard today. Lots of nice, fun stuff. And so people have been very nice to me. One thing that's been very interesting about going on tour, it's my first ever tour, is I hadn't realised how many white fans I've got. And I love it. I love you people. You're my favourite of all the races. It's because you've got the money and the power, innit? So. But yeah, it's at its heart, it's just a feel-good show. Just if it's about anything, it's about the fact that all of us present different versions of ourselves at all times. That's just what it is. And there's an extra layer of interest because I'm an Asian man who happens to be deaf, who happens to be from a Muslim background. So I've had to pretend to fit in all sorts of environments. And I've got to the level of my life and age and maturity, I guess, where I feel like I don't have to anymore.
Yeah.
People have really had a lovely time. I got a very nice review in The Times. That was very good, 4 stars. And one thing I've got a lot from people is people have said to me that I've made them think about things in a way they hadn't really thought about before, which is a lovely thing to hear from a comedy show when that wasn't really the intention. It's just the way I think.
Yeah.
And if it just so happens that the way I think resonates with people to the point where they go, oh, actually, yeah, maybe refugees are a bunch of arseholes. You know, I just didn't think about that. Honestly, my girlfriend's dad took some Ukrainian refugees in for 6 months. And within 3 weeks, he was a bit like, fuck me. This is hard work, isn't it? But I've got to be nice to them because they're refugees. But they do no domestic work.
I don't think you
The dishes will change a person. If you don't do the dishes the way you're supposed to, people get angry.
Yeah. I don't think you're taking in refugees in the hope they'll do the washing up, though, are you?
No, but you kind of want, like, people to pull their weight, even if they're refugees, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
No? Your audience fucking hates this bit. They hate this bit, Guardian reading fucking.
My parents-in-law have taken refugees.
Have they?
Yeah, but they...
White or brown?
Brown, actually, mainly brown.
Really?
In fact, I think all brown.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm so proud of them. That doesn't happen very often.
I know. I think they wanted white ones, but they...
We've got the B-list for you.
You can't say we'll take him in. They go, oh no. I'm joking.
That's great. I love that.
They're many things, but they're not racist.
I love that. That makes me honestly really happy.
But yeah, it is. But that's what was, you know, that was going on with John Barnes and Andrew Castle. I don't know if you saw that. This the week we're recording this is all the Gary Lineker stuff have been going on. But John Barnes was saying how people are taking in Ukrainian refugees, but they won't take in Syrian refugees or, you know, whatever, or they're not.
And your parents-in-law was like, not us.
I haven't talked to them about it, but, you know, but it is interesting that that there's been several wars and, you know, and there are a lot of refugees, apparently a billion refugees trying to get in who would come to the UK if it wasn't such a fucking horrible place to live. So well done to the Tories for making this an undesirable location, especially for anyone from abroad. But there we go. Yeah.
Well, good kudos to your parents-in-law.
Yeah, they're amazing.
What kind of brown do you know?
There's been everything. Well, my mother-in-law. I don't know how much I can. She'll want me to talk about her life, but she came from quite a disadvantaged background and there was a Sri Lankan family that she got very involved with, who she still sees, and actually one of her lodgers, one of the lodgers in the house, is one of the people who are essentially seen as our family, even though they were not related to us.
Yeah.
But the latest guy, I don't know, I should know where they're from. The latest,
somewhere brown.
The latest guy is a black guy. There's been three or four different guys.
Nice.
Yeah. He's only got one leg, I think, the guy at the moment. So, you know, that's what's...
What did your parents all do to him?
Yeah, they just... He tried to get away. Yeah. We might have to take some of that out, Ben.
Keep it in, Ben. Keep it in.
Might take some of that out. You know, I wouldn't do it myself.
Take brown ones in.
I wouldn't have any white, black, anything.
Listen, I'm from an Asian family, and what will happen is whoever, no matter how lightly related they are to you, they will come to the UK and they will set up camp in my family home and be there, well outstay their welcome. Yeah. They don't have that British sensibility of knowing there's a certain time that you have to leave. I had one distant family friend who lived with us for 16 months. 16 months. And my mum, God bless, rest her soul, bless her, was so British about it, she just couldn't ask her to leave. And after 16 months, my dad eventually had enough and he was like, fuck off, please. Come on, do not.
That is too much. I'm so cautious about outstaying my welcome, like for... Five minutes. I don't want to impose myself on anyone.
How do the women you've been with feel about that?
Pardon?
How do the women you've been with feel about that?
That's okay. I think if they've agreed to a relationship. Okay. I will stay. But it's, you know, I'm so nervous about that sort of stuff. The idea of staying at someone's house and you know, not going, oh, is this okay? Absolutely, you know. But I've got two kids and they're sort of refugees, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, I guess they are.
They're just people who turned up and you've got to look after them.
Do you ever go, like, boating with them and just see how far it can just keep going? Like, whoop. And so when the breakfast, they're going, no, fuck off, get back.
I don't do that, no. I love them very dearly, except when I'm trying to kill them in my car. Let's take all of us together. We can all go together. It'll all be fine. Might have to cut all of this podcast.
Oh, what a surprise. Ishan Akbar gets cut.
So, look, there's a few things, you know, because the comedy thing, like you say, there's loads of things that come out of this. Getting to be on Spitting Image, one of the voices on Spitting Image is pretty cool.
Yeah, and I talk about this in the show.
Right.
When Spitting Image came through as an opportunity, I was dead excited. And I talk about it in the show because I feel like the casting was very interesting. Because they called me up and they said, we'd like you to do some voices. Now, you've heard me speak for a while and you've probably gathered that I sound fairly English, I guess.
Yep.
They asked me to do the voices of Rishi Sunak, Sajid Javid, can you see a pattern? And Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Now, here's the thing. I'm not on screen. I'm just offering my voice. And I think I could just as well do those voices as I can at the time, say, a Dominic Raab or a Matt Hancock, whoever else. But that felt like a real diversity hire, that we got a brown guy and the only voices he can do are the brown people. And it's a bit of a weird mix because we tell white people that they can't do brown or non-white voices. And this is something I also talk about in the show. I completely and utterly disagree with that. I think that's nonsense to have that position. So it was a nice opportunity, but it really taught me so much about how the world views me, but also an entertainer who happens to be from an ethnic minority in the UK. That the, I wouldn't call it the limits, but the opportunities for me need to be brown related. You know, the fact that my first presenting job on radio was on the Asian Network, and then an Asian guy sacked me, what a surprise. It just made it a very interesting thing. So it was lovely to do, and I really enjoyed doing it. My song, Dishy Rishi, got loads of views on YouTube. I'm too dishy for this case. Too dishy for this face. I can't remember the rest. It was nice to do, but it was interesting that they asked me to just do those voices.
Yeah.
When you don't see me, and they wouldn't ask you to do Rishi Sunak for some inexplicable reason, even though he's a billionaire from Southampton.
Let me do it.
Do it.
Hello, I'm Rishi Sunak.
Right. I so wish you went, hello, I'm Rishi Sunak. What are you doing? I'm the Chancellor. Now I'm the Prime Minister. My mother-in-law hates my job. Why is he so camp? Oh, hi.
That would have been quite good speaking as well.
I would have loved it.
But it's sort of, it is, you know, but it comes to a point where acting becomes, you know, you can only be what you are.
Yeah.
It is a sort of, you know, I can understand why they want to, you know, to discourage that in some ways, or to encourage ethnic people to play ethnic roles, or gay people to play gay roles, or trans people to play trans roles. But equally, it means that, you know, it stops being a job of acting and becomes a job of being, you know, we have to get you to be exactly what you are.
I mean, I talk about this in the show, the biggest accent thing of recent years was Apu from The Simpsons. So I don't know if you know the story. Apu was a character on The Simpsons, and a comedian in America, Harry Kondabalu, was upset that Hank Azaria, a white man, had been voicing this character. And I fundamentally disagreed with his position.
Right.
And this is part of the reason why I think people think I'm a bit of a sellout. But I disagreed with it because growing up, seeing a character on The Simpsons, that, by the way, was his actual colour, everybody, amongst all these yellow faces, there was this one brown character. He was a PhD, he owned a corner shop, it was very on brand. And they were like, oh, this white man did the voice. What's the alternative? You say to an Indian man, we've written a character, he owns a corner shop, can you talk, please? Do you know what I mean? And we get ourselves into these knots. And I just think, to me, it wasn't a problem that Hank Azaria did the voice, because it's a comedy show, and you're going to ramp it up a bit. Sure, there might be some arguments that what he says, you know, he was like, hello, I'm owning a corner shop, I'm fucking stupid. Sure, that might be a problem, but that's not what was happening. And so we get ourselves into these knots, and, you know, we can't have a debate or a conversation about representation if we keep hammering home our differences to the point where we're beleaguered, non-whites are beleaguered, and you've got to make all the decisions. Because I just don't see it that way. And this might be my issue, that I'm so anglicised and I feel so English that I see myself entirely as an equal. I've never seen myself as someone who needs the support of a scheme or of any kind, though I apply to every single one. But it's this weird thing that we tell white people that, you're like, if you're a white person and you've had friends from different races, I would be astounded if at some point in your friendship you did not do your non-white friend's parents' accent back to them. Because that's what building friendship is. That's just what it is. And the intent with which you do it, I think, matters. So, yeah, that bit was much more serious than I intended.
But... Yeah, no, it's... Well, look, it's an interesting thing, and I think it is... I mean, one would hope within a generation or two it would become a comical thing and a ridiculous thing. But that's, you know, that's the way... You know, that the reason that stuff that in the 90s would have been seen as almost, you know, as progressive, probably, we've got an Asian Indian character, is now seen as being something different. But in 20 years' time, maybe the idea, you know, things that what you're saying, going, well, we're all equal, so why are we worrying about it?
Yeah.
That's ideally where we're heading, right?
But yeah,
I think,
yeah.
But I think we're not there yet. I mean, you might be there, but...
Yeah, maybe. So maybe not, this is what, maybe I'm ahead of the curve. Maybe I'm a visionary. Maybe I'm better than everyone.
But
maybe.
It's, you know, but... These things are worth, you know, it's worth discussing, and it's worth, you know, none of this stuff should become like solid. This is how it has to be forever, and it doesn't. That's the thing. That's why all of these issues become contentious, and why some people solidify their views and then go, "Why are things changing? I don't want things to change." And then some people are, you know, pliable, and things have to adjust with time. And I mean, I hope, you know, I just sort of feel with. Out of all the stupid things in the world, racism is the absolutely most ridiculous thing that you would hope by now people just went, why is that even why is that even a thing? It's fucking so ridiculous.
But the one thing I will say in defense of racism is is if it gets solved too quickly, I might not have a career.
Okay, that's true.
And that's pretty important to me. And I think, as you know, yeah, but all jokes aside, of course racism's bad. I don't want anybody here to be like, oh, Ishan thinks racism's all right. I'm going to punch a brown person on the way home. That's not how it works. Of course it's bad, but I think that I'm on the side, if we were to talk about this seriously, and not in my as a comedian, I'm on the side where, actually, just being audacious enough as a non-white person to view myself as an equal and behave like an equal, I think, for me, that will make things much better overall. That doesn't stop me from, like I said, slightly facetiously, applying from schemes that would help me. But fundamentally, I just see myself as an equal, and the colour of my skin just doesn't... I don't see myself as beleaguered in any way. And so, yeah, I don't know how I want to end that bit. I started becoming a brown supremacist rally there. Turning into, I love being Asian, I love being English, and I think they can both coexist equally 100% of the time, all the time.
Well, you know, one would hope so, and, you know, one would hope that's the way the world is going to be.
Yeah.
Because it has, you know, but it has to be as well, because it's not,
yeah,
you know, barring just some horrible eugenicist coming in and, and sending everyone back to where they think they should be, which would be quite hard to do. Even
I've got two boats to pick from.
Yeah, exactly.
Which one do you put me? Are there any Asians in tonight? there's one at the front. Hello, sir. Where's your family from?
Myself, a mixture.
Bangladesh and?
Well, it was all India.
Bangladesh and India. Nice to see you. Bharatan.
But I was born in
Lambeth. Where were you born? Lovely. Well, thank you, my Bengali brother. Are there any other Asians in? Let's see what Richard Herring's diversity...
I've got a very, very diverse group of IT, people who work in IT.
Do you know what I love?
Virgins who work in IT, but they're from every country in the world.
Right, he's got the lights up. Oh, there's one over there. Hello. Oh, couple, hello. Right, the Asians, we're here, united. Shall we fucking get them? Some of them are? Yep. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, that's a, you know, it's an interesting point. I can try and sum that up because there's obviously not been mic'd there.
Yeah.
But this gentleman's saying that not everyone's a rich banker, and that...
I'm not a rich banker, by the way.
Okay, well, you worked as a banker, but there's the danger that, you know, not everyone sees Asian people as equal. And so that if you, by you voicing that stuff, it could you know, be used by the opposing side. That's not a... You were much more eloquent than that. Sorry that I didn't get it.
That was a very good summary. Number one, this is why colonialism was such a clusterfuck. Asians just turn on each other all the time. I'm trying to have a nice time here. He's upset. Great. But fair enough, I understand your point. But also, me saying this doesn't negate the fact that those truths exist.
Sure.
Me saying this doesn't exist doesn't change the fact that my dad was a minicab driver who was stabbed by the members of the National Front three times in the course of his life. Those doesn't change the fact that when I went to the private school I went on a scholarship as the poorest, most Asian kid. Me being a banker, being the only Asian man in a building of 600 staff, those facts do not change. Me being homeless for 2 months and not being able to find support because the homeless charities I went to tended to be very white heavy and they didn't know what to do with me because you don't really see Asian people very much. And the thing is, my saying these points doesn't negate the fact that all those truths exist, or the fact that there is things are tough for non-white people around the world. I cannot change that. And within the realms of what I do as a comedian, by having fun, telling myself I have the audacity of equality, I feel like I'm just doing my thing. And if people don't resonate with it, that's absolutely fine. I just want to get another conservatory. And if people do resonate with it, that's great too. And whether it's problematic or not, that's also fine. We don't have to agree necessarily all of the time.
Of course, and I think the important thing is the issues are discussed. And
yeah,
you know, we weren't expecting to have some questions from the floor, but you did admit that, you know, you did agree that being fun, you know, humour is an important way of coping this subject. I think it was a very reasonable interjection, I have to say. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. By talking about this stuff, and you know, it's your personal experience.
Yeah.
And I think that I understand what you're saying, and I think, you know, I think that feeling of equality should be the feeling that everyone has. It isn't the feeling that everyone has.
Yeah, of course. Of course it's not.
But that's also something that we should be hoping will change.
Yeah.
So, you know, by talking about it, even in a comedic way, I think, you know, it's a very... To me, it's interesting now the kind of scope that comedy has that it didn't have in the... You know, even in the 80s and 90s, especially the 80s, where everything was meant to be alternative and, you know, open... There weren't many different kinds of voices. There were kind of crazy people, and there was, you know, it was a subculture, but it wasn't a massively diverse culture.
No, absolutely not.
And now I think comedy is getting to a point where it's much more diverse, and you're hearing voices from people. So to hear like routines from someone who's brought up as a Muslim, who's turned against Islam, or you know, rejected it as a religion, you know, that's an interesting viewpoint. That's not going to be every Islamic.
No, of course it's not. Of course not. And the internet democratizes funny, and the internet democratizes different opinions, and we're able to share those things, our perspectives, in those ways. Mm. And I have absolutely no desire to be a representative of any community, be it Asian people, Muslim people, fat people, deaf people. I can't do it. It's too much. I just want to have a nice time.
Sure.
And hope that people resonate with it. And who knew that today's Rahel Estepa would get this fucking tense?
Well, what I would suggest is that I ask you, which I do now know the answer to because it came up backstage by accident, but I, without knowing the reasons, I heard on a podcast you saying that the first time you ejaculated was in front of your mother. How would you like to... would you like to... Explain that. And this isn't the entire Asian experience.
Just to be clear, Asian families are close. No. So what had happened is when I was 12 years old, I was playing cricket, because obviously. And I couldn't feel my legs at one point, and it basically transpired that I'd experienced something called a testicular torsion, which is when your testicle wraps around itself into a knot. And I was...
Must be nice.
Yes. Well, the doctor did say I was 90 minutes away from becoming the new Richard Herring. They were going to amputate it after 90 minutes. And I was just told to just kind of try and rub the torsion out. Just rub my testicle until it kind of unknotted. And I was 12 years old. And it was the first time I'd experienced an erection.
Wow.
Pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. And when the nurse was told me after about an hour and a half that she was going to get the operating theatre ready, she walked out, my mum walked in, my testicle unravelled and I ejaculated everywhere.
And has that had any, knock on to your adult sex life?
Oh, yeah. Now whenever I come, I call out for my mum. But she, at the time, she just wrapped a hand around my shoulder and said, "Don't worry, son, this will happen again." I was like, "Fucking hope not. This is not something I want to happen again. Please, mum." So, yeah, that was the first time.
But you saved your testicle.
I saved my testicle. I have two working testicles,
wow,
Richard.
Must be nice. Coming in with your two testicles.
There was
plenty to talk to you about. There's lots of podcasts you've been involved in here and there. I was listening to you and Darren Harriet in Shame is Delicious.
Shame is Delicious, yeah.
Which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We talk about shame.
Yeah.
I feel none, he feels plenty, so okay, we talk about
that's
that.
That's good. You worked with Ben, our producer, on... Yep. Panic Room
on for Audible with John Robbins and Olga Kopp, where we envision situations that the world hasn't quite prepared itself for, such as, you know, can we forage for a better, healthier lifestyle? What do we do about pensions? How do we get rid of old people? And so Olga and I tried to find solutions to those problems that John Robbins was worried about. So that's on Audible. You can check that out as well.
That's very good. And the exciting news that I don't think you can talk about very much is you're in the fourth series of Sex Education, so you've got a big acting job.
I have got a big acting job. I am in the fourth season of Sex Education on Netflix. No one here was at all bothered by that information. What was annoying is when I announced that had happened, the number of messages I got from my fans, apparently, and my friends, asking me if I was a paedophile teacher. And do I give him a pedo vibe?
if it was a pedo teacher, I'd have got it. Those are my roles.
I don't think I give him a pedo vibe.
No, well, you know, all your friends and fans seem to think.
Yeah,
they do,
seem to
so
think
that's,
so.
That's not
so
being
I can
fake.
I can at least confirm that I'm not playing a paedophile teacher. Certainly not in this script.
Yeah. Do you think they can edit it to make it look like you
want? Who knows what could happen?
In post-production, they'll turn you into one.
This is Netflix. Anything could happen. So it's inexplicable that I'm in a Netflix show. I think it's absolutely mind-bogglingly baffling that I'm doing a Netflix show, but I'll take the money.
And was acting something that you were interested in getting into, or is it...
Not particularly. I'm just very naturally talented at stuff. I sound like such a wanker, don't I? Honestly, all the supporting actors I talked to, when they asked me, what drama school did you go to? And I said, I didn't. And then they said, what else have you been? And I said, I haven't. They were like, are you fucking kidding me? This is your first role. What had happened is I'd gone for the audition, and in truth, I'd forgotten about the audition, right? Because I was so busy with gigs. I got to the audition, and I saw a couple of other comedians walking out, one Asian, one black. And I was like, okay, they're going for a specific thing here. And I walked into, and there were loads of other people auditioning. They were all wearing tweed blazers. But I was wearing pretty much what I'm wearing now, which is like an overshirt and a T-shirt. And I was like, oh, fuck, I've really fucked this up. And then as we were walking, I said to the casting agent, oh, by the way, I've not read the script. I don't know it. I'm really sorry. She said, that's fine. So we did like three takes of each scene. Each scene in my head was getting worse and worse and worse. 3 weeks later, I'd forgotten about it. I called my agent and I said, listen, please get someone to teach me how to do auditions because I don't understand this. 3 weeks later, I'm in Liverpool with the Have a Word podcast where I was playing the role of a head chef at a restaurant. My agent calls me and he says, what are you doing? I said, I'm in Liverpool. And he goes, are you going to get hammered tonight? I said, yes, I'm in Liverpool. I'm going to get absolutely wasted. And he said, all right, well, try not to because tomorrow you have to go to Cardiff because you're in sex education.
Right.
That's literally what happened.
Wow.
I turned up, my first day of filming, I met one of the guys I was doing the scene with. I asked him if he'd been on the show long. He was Asa Butterfield. Who was the lead in the whole fucking thing. And he thought I was taking the piss, and I honestly wasn't because I've not seen the show. And then... we really got on. And then at the end of the day, we followed each other on Instagram. I just kind of scrolled down. He had a picture of him on GQ magazine. I messaged him to say, can't believe you put your Moonpig card up. That's jokes. And he said, no, that's the actual GQ magazine. I was like, all right. Then I scrolled up. I had 12,500 followers. He had 5.8 million. And I was like, okay, I'm dealing with the big leagues now. So yeah. It was a crazy thing. The filming's done. It's coming out later in the year. I'm dead excited about it. Let's see how people take to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of comedians have gone over to Hollywood, become big stars.
Yeah. Apu?
Yeah.
I think Apu needs to return, and I'm more than happy to do it.
Okay.
With my white voice. I might give Apu a very white voice, actually. But yeah, no, so it's the fact that I'm doing a Netflix show and, like, even thinking about Hollywood is just ridiculous to me. But I'll keep riding this wave and just have a nice time, really.
Well, it's good. It's, you know, if you're enjoying it and it's...
I'm having a great time. Yeah, I am... I'm a man generally of a very happy disposition. Life is hard and life is complicated, and I feel very blessed and lucky for all the opportunities that might come my way. And just like everybody in this room and whoever's listening, we've all had our hardships, whatever they're like. You know, I turned deaf in my mid-20s. I lost my mum very prematurely. I've had break. All sorts of things have happened. And the fact that I'm here now, talking to you, doing this, in November 2017, when... I tried to do something very silly to myself. I could never have envisioned that this is what would happen. And so every single day I count as a blessing. And whoever listens, even if you disagree with me, whatever it might be, I count as a blessing because it's been tricky at times. And this is amazing.
So. It's great to hear, man. It's thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure.
Talking about that. It's very interesting stuff. And the tour, The Pretender, very funny. 4-star review in The Times.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, please give out the amazing Ishan Akbar. Akbar. Thank you. You have been listening to Rehearsal with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Ishan Akbar. Scad Brigade provide the musical accompaniment to these titles. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre, everyone connected with Sky Potato and GoFasterStrike.com. Even George, the incompetent town man. It's been all right, innit? Come and see us live, LeicesterSquareTheatre.com. That's all I've got to say to you. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It will make me feel sad.